Welcome to that little rift between reality and what lies beyond. That's where we're going to be tonight. My name is Ted Peters, and I teach systematic theology at Pacific Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, California. I help to train men and women who will become future pastors. And maybe after this evening, you won't trust them in my hands anymore. We'll see. What I thought I would do for the next hour, I'd like to say a few things about how it is that I got interested in this particular subject, and then talk about the UFO phenomenon, and then lay on to you a theory that I have about the place that UFOs have in our culture that is dominated by science and repressing the religious dimensions of our life. Talk to you a little bit about the Roswell UFO crash and my own theory about UFOs, and then maybe the Heaven's Gate suicide tragedy. That sounds like a lot, and yes, it is a lot, but I would like to do it soon enough so that we'll have plenty of time for open discussion. There's no way I can even exhaust this particular topic, so I'll try to throw out in germinal form some of my thoughts and ideas, and then we'll see where perhaps the rest of you would like to take the conversation. I love this particular subject matter, and we could go 30 different directions. I grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, back in the 1950s, when I think I was conscious, I'm not sure. My mother and father got involved with following flying saucers. And they would go to hear George Adamski when he would come to town and talk about the landing of the airship from Venus and all of those kinds of things, and would read all the UFO books. And my contribution was to collect newspaper clippings of flying saucer sightings during the 1950s, and I created this great scrapbook of clippings. And over at Jim Baldwin's garage, where we used to play basketball, when we were taking breaks for Cokes, I would tell flying saucer stories from the newspapers. And I was not a very good basketball player, but they liked to have me around because I could tell good stories. And they were all skeptics until, I guess, our junior year in high school. And I got a telephone call late in the evening. My mother says, Jim is on the phone. And he's screaming, and he's all upset, she said. And I get on the phone, he's saying, Frank, that's what they called me in those days. He says, I just saw a flying saucer. And he described coming home from basketball practice, seeing a glowing light rising up and flying off into the sky. So the story's only got more interesting. Well, I went off to college at Michigan State and tried to divest myself of as much of my hometown Dearborn as I possibly could. And of course, nobody in Michigan State, so it seemed to a college freshman, would believe in God, let alone UFOs. And so I put away childish things, adopting the much more skeptical world of higher learning, and forgot about the subject. Then eventually I became a professor myself in the 1970s. And if you were awake in the 1970s, you may remember the ancient astronaut phenomenon. A Swiss hotel keeper by the name of Erich von Däniken sold 40 million books, advancing the theory that the great achievements of ancient civilization were the result of interventions from outer space. And when I saw the televisions and the movie theaters with the chariots of the gods, and saw what trash, what outrageous trash this was, I got my professorial dander up just about as high as it could go. And opened the Chronicle of Higher Education, And they listed the five books most widely read by college students apart from textbooks, and four of them were on sex, and one of them was on ancient astronauts. So I decided that American education had fallen too far, that I was appointed to do something about it. So I decided to offer a course in which we would teach people to think critically about the rise of ancient civilization, and then I remembered my scrapbook. I remembered that as a kid I was interested in this subject. So I called up my father on the phone and told him what I was going to do, and I said, "Do you remember the scrapbook I kept as a kid?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "I've been keeping it up." I had 25 years of newspaper clippings of the flying saucer phenomenon, so I had him mail it to me. So I prepared this course on critical thinking. I had a professor of the philosophy department to come in and talk about fallacies, and the librarian to talk about real research. And I had the students research all of the claims that were made about ancient astronauts. And I limited it to 18 students. 65 wanted to sign up, limited it to 18. And on the first day I said, "How many in this class believe the ancient astronaut theory to explain the pyramids, the statues at Easter Island, the designs on the plain of Nazca in Peru, and all that kind of thing?" And 17 out of 18 said yes, and one was undecided. When the class was over, I asked the same question, and 17 said no, and one was undecided. I don't remember if it's the same one. And I thought I had really struck a blow for reason and critical scholarship, and patted myself on the back for being a good professor. But the problem was, I was hooked. And I fell in love with the subject matter again. I joined three UFO organizations. I became a UFO investigator and started interviewing people who had sightings. And we had another interesting thing. During the first time I offered the course, I brought in other faculty who were experts in various areas, and there was an English woman. I have to mention that because I'm a sucker for an English accent. Anyone who speaks with a British accent has to speak the truth. That's just the way it is. And she was a closet Egyptologist, so I had her lecture on the building of the pyramids. And of course, it's impossible to think that there was any extraterrestrial intervention in that. And she made snide remarks, as the English can do with great charm, that anyone who would take this seriously, anyone who would even think that it belonged in a university curriculum, had to be mad and crazy. Well, at any rate, a week after she had delivered this lecture to me, she was driving down Interstate 25 with another professor in the car, and they saw a flying saucer. And not just them, everyone on the interstate did. All the cars pulled off to the side of the road as the flying saucer flew for 20 seconds in one direction and then in another and then shot off. So there were hundreds of witnesses to this, and I had her come back to the class and testify as a UFO witness. So over the years since then, I thought, well, I wonder if there's some way I can take this hobby and connect it with my academic work, and I'll say a little bit about that. You know, academics have a way of justifying almost anything if they can call it a theory. So tonight you're going to get my theory. A couple words about the UFO phenomenon, and I choose the word phenomenon rather than just talking about flying saucers or UFOs. The word phenomenon puts together what is seen with how you see it. So hence my flying saucer here with the glasses, both the object and the subject. And the thing that really concerns me is the way we interpret UFOs. It's not just that there are unidentified flying objects, but what is the lens through which we look at them? What is the frame, so to speak, through which we, in our culture, interpret these things, and our culture is going to interpret it different than others. But first of all, what are we talking about when we're talking about UFOs, unidentified flying objects?
There are various categories, and these are the categories of the late J. Allen Hynek from the Northwestern University Astronomy Department. First, you got daylight disks. That's just that's where your classic flying saucer comes from. See, this is the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the UFO phenomenon, which began on June 24, 1947. When right here in the state of Washington, not far from where we are, this is almost ground zero. On this side of Mount Rainier, Kenneth Arnold spotted 9 flying discs. And when he tried to describe them to the newspapers, they were called flying saucers. And that was where the term was born. I guess these flying saucers were flying at somewhere around 1,800 to 2,000 miles per hour, and at that particular time we didn't have airplanes that even could do Mach 1. So that's daylight discs or flying saucers. Fly-by nights. Those are lights that you see at night that can't be identified. And of course, if they're the planet Venus or a shooting star or a helicopter, that doesn't count. Because once you've identified a UFO, it becomes an IFO, an Identified Flying Object. Those are the uninteresting ones. The only ones that are interesting are those that after investigation you find out you cannot identify. And serious scientific investigation will usually yield 5 to 10% UFOs and turning all the rest into IFOs. Then there are the close encounters. CE-1 is a close encounter of the first kind, would be a UFO within 500 feet so that you can see detail. And I've interviewed a number of people who have had close encounters of the first kind. And of course, if you have multiple witnesses who are independent of each other, it's better than just a single witness isolated. CE-2s. Close encounters of the second kind are those in which there are physical components to it. And usually there are two forms of that. One would be landing trace cases, wherein perhaps you've got tree limbs broken, you've got a pattern. See, a UFO took off from here, where you can actually see that there's some physical trace from the landing. The second is electromagnetic effects. If you saw the second of the great UFO movies, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, in that one, you remember the guy's the truck. The radio goes off, and then his lights go off. Common dimension of the phenomenon for electromagnetic effects. Also, here are radar cases. In the great period from July 17 to July 29, 1952, when flying saucers swarmed over Washington, buzzing the White House, etc., they were tracked on radar by multiple radar stations. So that would be an example of a close encounter of the second kind. Close encounters of the third kind, as Spielberg says, that's when you see them. Close encounters of the third kind are claims that there are occupants of these craft and that there is some kind of interpersonal exchange that goes on. Included here would be the great contactees of the 1950s. I've mentioned George Adamski, who had a philosophical discussion with a man he claimed had come from Venus. Also, we would put the most recent phenomenon, post-1987 phenomenon of abductions. That's where these fellows get you out of bed and take you aboard a flying saucer. Or what we've had all the way through from the 50s, actually the late 50s, down through the 80s, the kind of abduction where a person's taken aboard a craft and laid on a table and then given some sort of physical examination, and that's still in the abduction phenomenon. Anyway, that is a really quick tour through the way we structure the phenomenon. And what I want to do is step back from this a little bit and see what are the sort of categories that we in our society, and this is a cultural analysis now, look at these. What is the frame, so to speak, of interpretation. This is my rendition of a picture frame. And I'm going to call this the UFO myth. Now, I use the word myth with a high degree of frequency, more frequently than most of my colleagues and friends do. And what I mean by it, a myth is a structure of thought, a conceptual set, a mental framework of categories that we interpret new experience through. This past week, I spent a lot of time talking about the gene myth, and that's the widespread belief in our society that it's all in the genes, that my DNA is deterministic of who I am. And the gene myth sits right on the point of connection between laboratory science and the social interpretation of that science. And the bookstore tells me I got to remind everybody about the books that are available on these subjects. So the book in the bookstore that deals with the gene myth is called Playing God. Then in this book, For the Love of Children, which is also in the bookstore, I deal with the inheritance myth. And by the inheritance myth, I mean the belief that is widespread, not just in our culture, but especially in ancient cultures, including the Bible, that somehow or other we have to have children who will carry on our blood, children with whom we have genetic continuity. And Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar believed in that. Jesus did not believe in that. And so, yet, it's a very common belief. It just strikes me as that's a framework for interpreting things. And with the contemporary controversies over genetics, the message of this book is we don't need to be saddled with the inheritance myth as we try to work our way through these problems. Then, getting closer to the UFO myth in the book on sin, I use the work of a theorist by the name of René Girard, who has an interesting theory of myth, in which he says that the function of myth is to create peace in society, to render rivals, enemies, friends. But in order to make it happen, there has to be a scapegoat. So here's my theory. Are you ready? This is the way I try to earn my paycheck. What I think is the framework for the UFO phenomenon is a marriage between science and religion. People ordinarily think that science and religion are enemies or rivals. But in the UFO phenomenon, they come together, and who is the scapegoat? The scapegoat is the U.S. government. Now you'll say, oh, Dr. Peters, you're just crazy. Well, give me a few minutes to prove it. Okay, here's my theory in a nutshell, that our post-Enlightenment culture has come to respect the scientific interpretation of reality as fundamental and maybe even exhaustive, maybe even total. And the scientific interpretation is materialistic in character. We even wonder if it could be atheistic in character. And so religious people are on the run. They're on the in the retreat. And it's sort of embarrassing in certain situations to let people know that we've got religious feelings and thoughts. And in fact, if you kind of grow up and become just saturated with our culture, you may never even gain the language to articulate religious sensibilities. Yet, I would argue that the human race is deeply religious in character, and just because our culture on the surface is not, doesn't mean that religion went away, or the need for God went away, or that religious symbols have lost their power. They still have a great deal of power. But we've got a contortion at work. And so people who really want to affirm their religious faith try to gain credibility by using scientific, or what they think to be scientific, language and conceptuality, and that the UFO phenomenon, even though you think of it, we ordinarily think of it as being very marginal, becomes really a little window through which we can see how our culture, in its broader sense, works. First of all, let me talk about the scapegoat, and then I want to get back and illustrate the theory. Why in the world would I say that the U.S. government is the scapegoat? Well, I just did my pilgrimage to Roswell early July, and on July 4, 1997, just a month ago, at 11 in the morning, I was at the site 23 miles north of the city of Roswell, where, so the people of Roswell say, on July 4, 1947 at 11 p.m., in other words, I was missing the original time by 12 hours, 49 years, 364 days, and 12 hours after the event, a flying saucer crashed and spilled the bodies of four, or maybe it was five, I can't remember, aliens out onto the ground, four of which were dead on the spot, one of which lived and allegedly was collected by the then U.S. Army Air Force and taken to an unknown destination, namely Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And collecting the story from the people of Roswell was a fascinating experience, as you probably know if you read Time Magazine and places like that, that thousands and thousands of people poured into Roswell for the big 50-year celebration. The media trucks were lined up, Fox, NBC, ABC, CNN, and one of the media people told me that nothing in recent times had more media coverage than, second only to the O.J. Simpson trial that he had seen. So the Roswell event was a national, actually an international event, people that were there from all over the world. Now, all the all-stars of contemporary UFOdom were there. The big, even Eric von Däniken, who I mentioned a little while ago, was a principal speaker. But the contemporary ones, Stanton Friedman and Linda Howe and a number of the others, speaker after speaker after speaker got up and denounced the U.S. government. So why? What's that got to? On the grounds that the U.S. government has been covering up this information, and if you go back to the Roswell newspaper of July 6, 1947, there it is. Flying saucer crashes, debris is laid around, it's collected by the military, and the next day is the military denies that it was a flying saucer, it was really a weather balloon. And so for a half century now, UFO true believers believe that the U.S. government is withholding this information. Now, if you are working for the U.S. government and the UFO community comes to you and says, we demand the information about what's going on with regard to extraterrestrials having landed here on this planet, and the government says, we have no information about any extraterrestrials landing on this planet. You can say, I still believe extraterrestrials have landed on this planet. The government is covering it up. The government is not in a position of never feeding the fires of the belief in the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Now, unfortunately, our government is pretty klutzy. It was klutzy in 1947. It was klutzy in 1952 when it established the Robertson Panel that invented the idea of debunking. That is to say, whenever someone files a flying saucer report, we debunk it. We officially say that it was a mistake in some other kind of phenomenon, or the person is crazy or a kook. That was government policy from 1952 to 1969 during the period of Project Blue Book. Then in 1969, that was abandoned, and but the UFO community now is always sees the U.S. government as the enemy, on the grounds that it is covering up information. Well, as the Roswell celebration approached, which was going to start over the 4th of July weekend, the United States Air Force accommodated the anti-government sentiment by publishing a report with a modest title, The Roswell Report, Case Closed. Now, fortunately, I was in Washington for some other reasons the week before and had a friend at the Pentagon. I said, please go over and get me a copy of this report. So I was able to read it on the plane on the way to Roswell. But the Air Force did put it in the media. You probably are aware of the Air Force report. Well, the Air Force said, among other things, that beginning in 1954, they had some experiments with balloons that included anthropoid dummies. That is to say, mannequins that looked like human beings, and they were dropped from balloons in order to do some testing. And that they think that what the people in Roswell saw in 1947 were these dummies that they had dropped after 1954. In the report itself, the report reads, the text reads, that those who claim to have seen the bodies of the aliens describe them as having four fingers, and of course that fits the description of the dummies that were dropped from the balloons by the government experiments. And then they showed pictures of the actual dummies. I counted the fingers. There were five fingers on all of the dummies. And let me just say that that incensed the UFO community, but the UFO community is a happy community. They're not like the Montana militia. And so there's a good deal of humor. And this is a shirt I bought in Roswell. I'm taking a look at what it says on the back. Anybody read it out loud? So I have a feeling that the US government does not have a conspiracy, but it really does have ineptness. And I think that the UFO community, basically your middle America, I mean, at Roswell, it was families with RVs and kids and barbecues. We're not talking about the Montana militia. Yet, I think the unanalyzed dimension of this is this tremendous. Well, one person who was an ex-Army intelligence officer said we should resist the U.S. government. It's time for resistance. So, all right, at any rate, like I say, the value of scapegoating the government is that then the bond between science and religion becomes invisible because all the hostility is aimed towards the scapegoat. Okay, that's the end of my theory. Now let me give you a couple of examples.
Questions?
Yes.
Out of the hundreds of countries that exist in the world, how many governments acknowledge the presence of UFOs?
Well, I don't know how many, but Brazil, Japan would be two major ones, Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, I don't know about the contemporary one. I had lunch one time, just fortuitously, with the ambassador from Brazil. It was in a Jesuit cafeteria, and I brought up the subject of UFOs. We were there for an hour and a half. It's a big subject in Brazil. But the U.S. government is, in some cases, the target also of the foreigners, but they don't get as excited as the Americans do about this. But like I say, it functions as a nice foil because if you don't have the evidence for the extraterrestrial hypothesis, you can still believe in it because the evidence exists allegedly, but it's being kept from us. I mean, in other words, you can't disprove the extraterrestrial hypothesis to a UFO true believer because they can keep claiming that the evidence continues to exist. You see the structure? Okay, let me let me work on religion, or I'm going to call this actually religious sensibilities getting filtered through a scientific mindset. One of my the people I interviewed as a UFO witness is a guy named Dick Jackson in Fort Myers, Florida. This is some years ago now. And Dick told me the following. He was in bed, sound asleep. For some reason or another, he started to get restless. Somewhere around 2 or 3 in the morning, he gets up and he walks outside. Lives in a trailer park. And settling down in a clearing near the trailer park is a glowing, classic flying saucer like I have drawn here. And it hovers just above the ground, and he walks over to it. And a door opens, and a man appears in the door, waving for Dick to come in. Dick is a little bit cautious, but eventually he goes into the flying saucer. And once he gets in, he sees basically a plain room with a desk-like affair and a second being on the inside. I said, well, what do these beings look like? Said, well, they were about 5'2" and Caucasian, maybe a little bit darker than Caucasian, sort of Italian, he says. The man addressing Dick and inviting him to come in is saying, we're not going to harm you. We would just like to have you come in so that we can have a conversation with you. And Dick Jackson says, he spoke to me in perfect English. I said, well, what do you mean by perfect English? Well, he didn't have an accent. And he used perfect grammar. He says, I know perfect English when I hear it. Now, in my house, my wife, who was a first grade teacher, will tell me, perfect English, Ted, is when you don't say, ah. So, he had perfect English. Dick Jackson then walks up 3 steps, goes through the portal, and he says, it was big enough for me to go through without ducking. How tall are you, Dick? I'm 6'4". He says, there are some doorways that I have to duck under. And he says, as I went through, I had the strange sensation that I was being cleansed. It was sort of like a vacuum cleaner was cleaning me all over. So he gets inside the craft now, and craft I think was his word, and he notices the second man go and open up a little door in the wall, and Dick looks and he sees a lot of wires, and these wires are in the form of field winding. Those are those magnetic wires that you see inside an electrical motor. And Dick's telling me, he says, so I thought maybe if that's field winding, then the floor must be the armature. Maybe the whole thing is an electrical motor. So he says now to the UFOnaut, how does this thing fly? I mean, every 12-year-old boy is going to ask that question. It's going to be number one on the list, right? How does this thing fly? Dick is a technical person, kind of engineer, fix-it man sort of thing professionally. How does it fly? And the Spaceling says, well, it'd be too hard for you to explain, but it's electrical and it's magnetic, and we have to get electrical power from time to time to make it work. But that was about all the detail on how it flies. Well, when they get into the conversation, the visitor explains that they come from another planet, which is unnamed, but there is a third planet that is currently unoccupied, and they are going to create a new civilization on this planet. And what they would like to do would be to colonize that civilization with beings from Earth. Now, in this society, it's going to be different from life that we know of it here on Earth. There won't be any unmet needs. There will be plenty of food to eat and drink to have, and everyone will have their own home.
And in this society, it'd be very well organized, so there won't be any conflict, there won't be any need for police departments, there won't be any international strife. And that everything that we need will be supplied in this civilization. And if you need meaningful work, you'll also have meaningful work. I said to Dick, I said, well, is that important to you? He says, yeah, it's really important. He says, I don't think I could live without meaningful work. I said, Dick, I think I've heard of this place before. What do you think about this place? He says, sounds like heaven to me. I said, well, it sounds like heaven to me, too. They get around then to explaining that they would like Dick to be a recruiter and that he should go out and find other people who would want to come and make this trip. But if they come, they have to leave everything behind. They leave their families behind. They leave their professions behind. They leave their possessions behind. And he also said, you can't even take buttons. He says, it's okay to have your clothes tied together, but no buttons. I don't know, by the way, I have no idea why the spaceman said that, but it was important to Dick. And so all of this really sounds good. I said, well, what did you tell him? He said, I told him I didn't think I could do it. Well, why not? Well, he said, I've been diagnosed by my doctor as having a terminal illness. In fact, he listed two illnesses, both of which might contribute to a heart attack, and he would die young. He said, in fact, the doctor told me I only have 2 years to live, maybe less. And so I used to be living in Texas, but now I came back to Florida. You probably can guess the next line, the state where I was born. And I said, well, do you think about your impending death very much? No, never think about it. Well, you just mentioned it to me right now. No, I never think about it. I said, well, did you tell the people from space about your terminal illness? Yeah, I told them that. Now let me ask you, what do you think was the answer that the man from outer space gave Dick?
Either it doesn't matter.
We'll cure you.
We'll cure you. That's right. He says, we have physicians that will be able to cure you, and you'll live a long and prosperous life. I said, well, Dick, didn't that sound like good news? He said, yeah. He says, but I told him I'd think it over. So Dick did not accept on the spot this commission, or I would call it a prophetic call, to go out and recruit. And so evidently they parted friends, and he said he left the craft and the door closed, and then he said the thing just shot up in the sky and got higher and higher and higher until it finally disappeared. Well, what'd you do next, Dick? Well, he says, I went back to bed. I said, was everything normal the next morning? Yeah, everything was normal. I said, did you remember it all? Oh, he says, I remembered it all. Well, what's going on with Dick? Well, let's not talk too much psychologically, but just let's look at, oh, I forgot one very important interchange. I said, Mr. Jackson, are you a religious man? His answer was, hell no. I said, gee, you say that with some emphasis. Why do you say it that way? He says, I can't believe in God. I said, well, why not? Well, I can't believe that there's a God who's an old man with a beard that runs everything. He says, I think religion is okay for children, teaches them how to behave. Well, not when you grow up. All right, now to my analysis. I think that in the UFO phenomenon in general, and in the Dick Jackson case as sort of an example, there are at least four religious sensibilities at work. Now, by this, by religious sensibility, I don't mean going to church. I don't mean institutionalized religion. I mean those dimensions in human consciousness that, so to speak, make us open for
discussions of God and the realm of reality beyond us. The first is transcendence. UFOs, in general, and definitely in Dick Jackson's case, bear the power of transcendence.
What do I mean by that?
They come from beyond. They come from beyond the finite world in which we live. Oh, no, Dr. Peters, you might say. They don't come from beyond the finite world. They just come from another planet. There's a long way away, but they're still finite. Well, at the level of sensibility, those are not distinctions that we make. In ancient culture, the sky was the primary symbol of transcendence. Lay on the beach on a sunny day. Well, actually, you could lay on the road here in Holden on a day like today and just look at the sky. What do you see? Well, you see a long way. And what you see just goes and goes and goes. Now put a sun in that sky or a moon in that sky. Or how about a thundercloud with lightning? And the sky communicates distance, awe, power, things way beyond our control, things that communicate to us a sense of minuteness. And then just think of the symbolism that we get in the formative period of our religious traditions in the ancient world, including the Bible. Just read the Psalms. El Olam, one of the names for God, is God Most High. God in his heaven creates the sun, the moon, and the stars are products of his handiwork in that fashion. In ancient Greece, you got Mount Olympus, hidden in the clouds of the sky, and up there, that's where the gods dwell. So the sky, just go through the LBW sometime looking for hymns with sky symbolism. You don't have to go very far. And see, those symbols communicate transcendence. Of course, we in the 20th century don't believe that the sky is holy anymore. We have weather reporters, and they tell us what the sky is going to do tomorrow. Science and technology have conquered the sky. Even if the weather reporter is wrong 7 days in a row, we still have confidence in the science and technology of weather reporting. We get in jet airplanes. We get up in the sky, fly at 36,000 feet. We don't see Zeus up there, do we? The Russian astronaut, the first one in outer space, remember, was ideologically an atheist. He says, he went up 100 miles. He says, I went up into heaven and there's no God there. You see, it proves that atheism is correct. So we, in the 20th century, we can't believe in sky symbolism anymore. But right behind the sky that we conquered was another one, outer space. And outer space does for us and our culture what Mount Olympus and the sky did for the ancient Hebrews and for the ancient Greeks. Of the first 26 American astronauts that went into heaven, 12 or 13 reported religious experiences during their flights. Outer space, for our whole culture, communicates transcendence. Even does so for Carl Sagan. The late Carl Sagan, who despised religion. And you can see the way he disdains religion in this movie Contact, which is now floating around. So he officially opposes religion. He characterizes it as atavistic and antagonistic. Yet he takes the religious power of outer space and just co-opts it for science. So that even in, just take a look at the movie Contact, you got heaven there, right? Heaven in outer space. But now it comes to us courtesy of science, but not religion. The UFO phenomenon from June 24 right on down to the present day has been associated with outer space. Even for those who don't believe that UFOs have any connection with extraterrestrial intelligence, it's an association. It certainly was for Dick Jackson. The second is perfection. why does Dick Jackson say, have to even mention that the spaceland speaks in perfect English? Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst, wrote a book in 1959 called Flying Saucers, Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. And he capitalized on the shape of the flying saucers in the 50s. Actually, flying saucers come in a variety of shapes. Wanted to take a look at the circular shape, which is fundamentally a symbol of perfection. You can see it in the form of halos in Christian art or medieval art, the bright shining sun in a circular shape around saints, etc. I think that's pushing it a little bit, but the symbolism of perfection is there. And it's closely tied to another quality, omniscience. And the omniscience that we have in mind here is a projection of the way we know things in our modern technological society. Yeah? The word omniscience means all-knowing. Okay? We've got hymns, but certainly philosophical theologians who keep telling us that God is omniscient in character. Well, we in our modern world, the kind of knowledge we value the most is technological knowledge and scientific knowledge, but we build into this knowledge a time factor. Knowledge is on the move. We call it progress. Technology is progressive. The knowledge that supports technology is progressive, and so we have in the modern world said reality is that way. And the two big concepts, scientific concepts, that drive the UFO myth are evolution and progress. But progress is the fundamental one, because with progress, you can see that over a period of time, things get better and better and better. And it took the doctrine of progress in the Industrial Revolution to make the theory of evolution culturally possible, in which you would look at the whole history of the natural world and see development. Now, rigorous neo-Darwinian evolutionary theorists say there is no purpose in evolution. They say there is no progress in evolution. I don't know if that's just because they eat a lot of sauerkraut or what, but they are insistent that in nature there is no discernible purpose. That's what the scientists in the raw say, but not our cultural interpretation of evolution is not that way. We assume that with evolution things get better. So Oprah Winfrey, when telling us her New Age spiritual beliefs, says, I am an evolving person. And she means by that she is getting better. So evolution is thought of in our culture in general and the UFO myth specifically as a way of understanding reality is changing, reality is getting better, and in the UFO myth, the spacelings come from another civilization allegedly that has evolved longer than ours. They have progressed technologically further than we have. They have gained more knowledge than we have. We're on the same track, right? But we're just behind them. Or in the case of Carl Sagan, who doesn't believe the UFO myth, but he believes the ETI myth. And in the movie, you can remember Jodie Foster saying, in the movie Contact, saying, well, you see, they could have evolved millions of years more than we have. And look at all the much more knowledge that they have got. And then you just move from technological knowledge, maybe to political knowledge, they know how to organize the human race better, maybe to ethical knowledge, they know how to avoid certain conflicts and evils that we haven't learned, and pretty soon, maybe they have attained the perfect society on the planet Planta that Earthlings, selected Earthlings who are willing to give up everything about our way of life here can go there to live on. And so the two spacelings and talk to Dick Jackson are not omniscient in the mystical sense, but certainly they know so much more than we do technologically that they don't even have the time to explain how the ship flies to Dick. Finally, redemption. Planta will have a society in which all of the injuries and ills of our world will be healed. Even Dick Jackson's own terminal illness will be healed. That the flying saucers are finally our celestial saviors. Now, this is a thought structure, a construct. It is a frame, so to speak, through which things work. Dick Jackson personally cannot believe in God. He doesn't go to church. Church is okay for children, but intellectually he's a grown-up. I mean, this, the whole concept of what makes things modern and the Christian period prior to the modern age is the Dark Age, right? You can see that in textbooks, the Dark Age. So now we're in enlightenment, the age of enlightenment. You grow up, you get knowledge, and you put away religious things. Dick Jackson is a microcosm of the last 400 years of Western history when he says he can't believe in an outdated God. He can believe in evolution. He can believe in technological progress. But his own need to face his own death can't be handled in those terms. And so you get this contortion as you try to deal with a hope for redemption. In that kind of language. Well, anyway, so that's basically my theory. I gave you one example, and I want to give you, I'm just sort of, I can't read my watch very well. What time we got?
Quarter after.
Let me try 5 minutes on Heaven's Gate, and then I'd like to open things up. There are a large number of UFO cults, that is to say religious groups, who have developed a whole theology in which UFOs play a major role. And these religious groups were already forming in the early 1950s. I think the Etheria Society, which continues to exist, was already in existence around 1954, perhaps. And the doctrines of these UFO groups, for the most part, look a lot like the doctrines of the Heaven's Gate group in Rancho Santa Fe. And that group is not unique. The mass suicide, yeah, that's not an everyday occurrence, but the structure of belief is not all that unusual. Where did this group come from? I'm going to call them the Heaven's Gate. They kept changing their names through the years, but in 1974, 75, they were called the Two. Marshall Herf Applewhite was one. He died as Doe. And Bonnie Truesdale Nettles was the other. And she was T. Doe and T. They called themselves Bo and Peep, he and she. And they decided that they are the two prophesied in the book of Revelation, chapter 11, verses 11 to 12. Let me read that passage to you. But after the 3.5 days, a breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and those who saw them were terrified. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies watched them. I said, what in the world does that have to do with UFOs? Well, for Applewhite and Nettles, it had a lot to do. The cloud, they can't believe in clouds. Well, the cloud was really a flying saucer. You go back into the Bible, and these odd-to-interpret things are really flying saucers. We call that hermeneutics in the seminary. And it was a flying saucer that took them up. Now, Applewhite and Nettles identified themselves with the two prophesied in the book of Revelation. They foresaw that they themselves would be slain in the streets. They would rise from the dead, and a flying saucer would take them to the equivalent of Dick Jackson's Planta, and it was called the Kingdom of Heaven. And their teaching said the kingdom of heaven is a physical realm. It's just located somewhere in outer space. These people are materialists. Yet they pulled a little linguistic trick. They still talk about the battle between the body and the spirit. It's just that the spirit is another form of body for them. The bad body is the one that we have here on earth. The good body is the one that we have in this physical realm known as the Father's kingdom. So we have to get from here to there, but in order to do that, they said, we have to go through what they called human individual metamorphosis. They used the image of the butterfly getting changed from a caterpillar. And so they wanted to exact what we today call spirituality, a severe discipline wherein there would be a transformation from within. And when this transformation would be complete, then we would be metamorphosed, and then we could go and live in this kingdom of God in space forever. The model is Jesus Christ. And they studied those resurrection accounts as to how Jesus could have a body but walk through doors, how he could do these sort of non-locatable things but still eat fish for breakfast. They really concerned about this. They said all of us could be like the resurrected Christ if we go through this human individual metamorphosis. And once we've accomplished that, then, and they said back in the 1970s, a flying saucer would land, we would get on board, and it would fly us to God's kingdom. Well, they recruited some followers, and they went to the location, the right time, the flying saucer didn't land. So, they had to try Plan B. And but all through the years, 25 years now, they've been working on their human individual metamorphosis. In the meantime, Bonnie Nettles dies in 1985. I have to believe that must have been unexpected, don't know. They went into obscurity. They were really in the news through 1976. Then they deliberately went into obscurity. They resurfaced about 1991, I think, made a whole bunch of new recruits. And then what precipitated the tragedy was the appearance of the Hale-Bopp comet. And when the Hale-Bopp comet appeared, it was named after two astronomers, Mr. Hale and Mr. Bopp. When this appeared, there was a charlatan who appeared on a talk show who said that, I don't know, charlatan's the wrong word, I didn't mean to say that, an amateur astronomer. Who appeared on a television talk show and said that he had spotted a flying saucer or UFO in the tail of Hale-Bopp. Other astronomers checked it out and they saw, no, that's not true, that yes, there's a distant star that could be seen through it, but there is no spacecraft in the tail of Hale-Bopp. Well, this is the day of the internet, and so the UFO believers are now sending all over the place. This is last fall of 96, winter of 97, all this stuff about this spacecraft in the tail of Hale-Bopp. Doe, that's Herb Applewhite, says, this is the omen we have been waiting for. And what we will do is we will commit suicide, and we will travel in a disembodied state from here 100 million miles to the craft. And then the craft will take us to the physical kingdom of God. 39 people were involved in the original suicide. One of them was the wife of another man, and he wanted to go with his wife. And so after the suicides, he did his NBC interviews and his newspaper interviews, and then he committed suicide. So now there are 40 who have died in this regard. Just prior to the suicides, they put on the web a little statement that said, our position against suicide. If you read it very carefully, it's sort of like Socrates' remarks just before he drinks the hemlock, in which he asked the question, is it better to live or to die? And in this case, they described as death life on this planet. And they described as life dying to this planet to go to another realm. I didn't read this until after the suicides. And it was written in such a way as to just be tricky, but it was clearly an announcement of what it is they were planning on doing. Now, are other UFO cults likely to follow this route? Is it necessary from the teachings, the doctrines of these groups? No, I don't think it is. I think that this was extreme. I'm not of the bashing type where I want to say we've got an insane leader in Marshall Herf Applewhite, you know, and that all these people were stupid and they fought. I don't want to de-dignify these people with that kind of thing. Even though I think it was clearly his leadership finally that led to this kind of decision. But in some ways, retrospectively, through hindsight, it was being led up to this for 25 years. It was this willingness to accept death with the promise of resurrection and then understood in this particular way. Well, the long and the short of it is there's a lot going on in the UFO phenomenon. I do not attempt by this framework to explain everything, but at least it's a way of getting at a couple of things. Why is it that the UFO phenomenon has a pretty consistent form and has been there for 40 plus years? I think that this is the reason why. I think it also indicates that religious sensibilities have not gone away in the human psyche, despite the fact that science and technology have got such a grip on our culture. And I think, thirdly, those of us who are devout Christians need to keep quizzing our own minds repeatedly to find out how things are working in our minds, and what is it that comes from God that is genuine and healthy and grace-filled, and what is it that is twisted and contorted and possibly destructive in character. That's an ongoing task for the church and the society. I'm not calling for missionary zeal to UFO believers at this particular point. And I also have to confess one more thing. I think it's just a fascinating topic, and I think it's a lot of fun. So those are my remarks. Let me just see what kinds of things you all have on your mind.
What happened to Jackson?
I don't know. I tried subsequently to make contact, but nobody in his trailer park, or no address, no forwarding address. I wanted to know whether he died or whether he left the planet. Never could find out. But he never felt obligated to send me a letter. Yes?
In all of your queries to UFOs, were you ever approached by the Men in Black?
Was I ever approached by the Men in Black, she asked. No, I have not been. I'd like to be, though. I don't think I'd be afraid of them. Yes?
You cite Jackson. Have you ever run into anyone that sounded more credible or seemed less credible?
Oh, yes. And I could rank them from really credible to really doubtful. And I would put the Jackson case on the doubtful side. I mean, my own surmise is this was a dream. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed extremely real to him, and I don't want to just kind of dismiss it, but it just looks too perfect, you know, to not be a dream. But in the case of the Charles Hicks and Calvin Parker Pascagoula, Mississippi case of October 11th, 1973, if you may remember, some of you weren't old enough to remember, but in that case, you've got the two fishermen on the banks of the Pascagoula Mississippi River. They're taken aboard a silvery craft. They're given this kind of physical examination. This was worldwide news for weeks. And I interviewed Charles Hickson in that particular instance, and I made a cassette tape, and I had connections with a detective agency in New Orleans at the time to do psychological stress evaluators, which is really a very effective form of lie detection. And he passed the lie detector test, you know, in terms of his claims. So I would rank that a little higher on the credibility list. That doesn't mean that everything he described I would believe equally, but that a traumatic experience happened to him, yeah, I would think so. And then, of course, you have to rank how startling a case is versus how mundane a case is. But yeah, I've had a number of them that I would put pretty high in the credibility list. Yes?
What about the March sightings in Phoenix this year, where hundreds of people saw this and didn't report it until 2 or 3 months later?
All right, it was reported at the time.
But not really very, very broadly.
Well, that's part of the controversy was that you got lots of people taking videotapes of the UFO at night. And there maybe some people from Phoenix know, I guess there was a news team or something that could have just gone up on the roof and gotten professional pictures of it, and they didn't for some odd reason. And so the actual existing videos of this object are subject to contention, debate, as to what the quality is. But that's about all I know about this case. Does anybody in the room know more about the Phoenix? I think it's in April of 97.
Well, they were interviewing people on, I think with CNN, they showed the interviews just the last month. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about these people were very, very credible, and they were describing how this came right over the top of them, and they could have hit it with a baseball. And they could see the detail and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all kinds of people that said the same sort of thing.
In your judgment, some credible?
Watching those people, they tend to sound like they're kooks. They sound incredible.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these abduction things include pretty detailed physical exams and especially a lot of probing going on,
right,
which I've always assumed is some sort of sexual component. How does all that examination fit into the your four categories there?
Well, let me mention that this frame that I have here does not account for a lot of the components of the abduction phenomenon. Prior to 1987, you'd take abduction cases and they would look like this. Charles Hickson would be a good one, but the Sandy Larson case, one that I looked into, and some others, where you would be abducted, there might be some missing time. While you are in the spacecraft, you're laid on an examination table, the aliens behave sort of like doctors. They're scientific in their demeanor, in the way they move. They're sort of impersonal, they're systematic. In other words, the image of the scientist. And then they do these physical exams. Actually, the prototype is the Betty and Barney Hill case in 1962. And most of the other ones follow this particular pattern. Quite frequently, there's something put in the nose so that the person a day later has got a nosebleed or an ache in the nose, one of the continuing features of it. Now, that's the way it's read up until 1987. From 1987, now they're interpreted in terms of sexual abuse. You have new cases in which there's sexual contact between the aliens and the Earthlings, and then they go back and reinterpret some of the early ones. So those of you who have studied hermeneutics, believe me, this is a handy discipline, because you can see reinterpretations of things going on constantly. The 1980s is a period in which, this is the Ted Peters interpretation now, okay, in which our culture is rife with discussions of sexual abuse, okay? You've got parents abusing their children. You've got all kinds of professional abuse against women. You've got the rise of satanic ritual abuse in 1983 with the McMartin preschool trial, which actually begins in 1980 with the publication of a book that started it all called Michelle Remembers. So by the time you get to 1987, the UFO phenomenon changes with the publishing of two books by two authors who know each other. And the first one is Communion by Whitley Strieber, and the second one is The Intruders by Bud Hopkins, both of which become movies. All right, the current focus is on Whitley Strieber, Bud Hopkins, and John Mack, the psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School, all of whom now describe abductions as aliens who either rape Earthlings, both men and women, or get consent from Earthlings, and then they produce these hybrid children, which are what? The marriage of heaven and earth, basically. And the task now is to create another race, which is a mixture of Earthlings and heavenly beings. Well, at this point, I mean, nothing seems to be nailed down, at least from my point of view anymore. And neither John Mack, nor Bud Hopkins, nor Whitley Strieber will work with the extraterrestrial hypothesis. So they've kind of left the UFO myth. Do we have Vespers?
Right now.
We have Vespers. Bye.
Thank you.